It's Dr. Greg Poland, professor of medicine and director of the Mayo Vaccine Research Group at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota.
Perhaps it's noteworthy, doctor, that we're talking on the last day of March. So as you look back over the last 31 days, and back to March 1st, where are we? Where have we come from?
Boy, what a change in the world, huh, in that amount of time. So if you look back to March 1st, in the U.S., we had 74 cases and 2 deaths. As of this morning, we have almost 165,000 cases and 3,100 deaths.
And as we look into, and the uncertainty is because it's a novel virus, we don't yet know what the ultimate end of the game is, but what are your concerns over the next several days and maybe week to 2 weeks about where we are and where we're going?
Yeah, this is a really important question, Rich. Thank you for asking it. The key thing, and I think it's been very difficult for the public to understand this, what we are seeing today in terms of number of cases and deaths reflects what was set in motion 14 to 28 days ago, i.e. there's a lag period. We have not yet hit the peak of this. There's no evidence of that. Meaning, when we start to see the effects of social distancing, which take 14 to 28 days, we will have to wait a month after seeing a downturn in cases before the all clear, so to speak, can be sounded. There is a lag period, and people will have to understand that. They cannot look at any one point in time, like today, and say, well, here's what tomorrow or next week brings because of this lag period.
So does that put us even further beyond the end of April that the president and the White House Coronavirus Task Force had announced Sunday?
Yeah, I think, you know, what they're doing and what all of us are doing really is we're building the airplane while we're flying it. We have exactly 12 weeks experience with this virus. And I think it was appropriate that they extended the social distancing time and guidelines out. I suspect we may have to go even farther based on the behavior of this virus.
How have the behaviors from the research standpoint changed over recent days and weeks and what we've learned? One of the things that sticks out in asking that question is the initial reporting was more focused on the elderly and weak immune systems and that sort of thing. And yet we see a child as young as 5 years old in Duval County contracting it.
Yeah, no, you're very right. You know, while 80%, meaning 20% are not, 80% of the deaths are in people 65 and older. That doesn't exclude death in younger people. It's just more uncommon. And certainly younger people contract severe disease. If they don't have corresponding medical problems, and many of them don't, the question becomes why? And this is a focus of my own lab's research as well as our work on developing a vaccine. And we think it's genetic variations in the immune response genes and the gene that makes the receptor for this virus in our cells. So there's a tremendous amount of research going on, which has never happened as quickly in the history of mankind. So this is we're living truly in very interesting times. I think the other thing that has become clear, especially to the public, is this can be a serious disease. I mean, you now have the NIH, CDC, et cetera, saying, while we may be at 3,000 deaths today, expect somewhere between 100,000 to 200,000 deaths by the time this is over. In Italy, which has really been hard hit, 61 of the initially responding physicians are now dead. We have to take this very seriously. We're learning more and more about how this can affect the lungs, the heart, about the more prolonged shedding in sputum and feces. So I think it would be very naive of people to say, well, we understand this. This isn't going to affect me. This isn't serious for me. This is serious at one level or another for everybody. Differentially, yes. But, you know, whether we're young or old, we may have parents or grandparents or neighbors that are at much elevated risk, and we have to protect them by our own behaviors.
In the last week to 2 weeks, a lot of local efforts have been focused around the expansion of testing, rapid testing that may ultimately be coming online fairly soon and maybe running concurrently to that, the additional physical distancing guidelines that have been offered. And I know that's happening in communities across the country. Is the focus, generally speaking, in the right areas? Testing does yield analysis and results, or are we spending too much time on testing and should we be focusing in another area?
Well, I think testing really is important. And, you know, Mayo Clinic, Jacksonville, Rochester have been leaders here, and kudos to them for that. The reason it's important is think of this disease like a pyramid. Most of our knowledge has been the tip of the pyramid, those sick enough to access medical care for us to know about them. What we don't know is how big and how wide is this base? It must be pretty big. If we're seeing today 164,000 cases in the U.S., is there 3 times that, 10 times that, 100 times that of people who have had mild disease where they've attributed it to something else or no symptoms? And that's what the value of testing does. It also allows us to do tracing of contacts. You come in with a disease and we're able to test you. We now know something about risks for your family, for anybody you've had contact with, if you've flown on an airplane, et cetera. So it's actually very valuable.
What are the slivers of hope that you're looking at? One thing that stood out in just analyzing the data was that for the first time in 2 weeks, the number of deaths in the U.S. at least did not double over a 3-day period, and yet we still had over 500 people die in one day.
Yeah, I don't see that so much as a sliver of hope. The numbers day to day are somewhat less interesting than the numbers, say, week to week. That is where we see a trend that continues. I think something that is very hopeful, and this is going to sound simplistic, but if you think about it, it's pretty profound. You cannot get infected with this virus if you don't breathe it in or you don't introduce it into your eyes, nose, or mouth with your fingers. You cannot get infected with it. Well, that's very hopeful because then if I adhere to the social distancing guidelines, if I adhere to self-isolation, if I have any symptoms, if I really do wash my hands as frequently as they should be and in the proper way, I won't get the virus. And I think that's hopeful because it tells everybody has a role in this. It's not, I'm pinning my hopes on an antiviral or a vaccine. Those aren't going to come for a while. But there's something you can do today, and that's wash your hands and maintain these social distancing guidelines.
Across the country, I'm sure you've seen the images of people who are flouting that. If you could grab someone by the two shoulders and look them in the eyes and tell them one message, what would it be?
You know what I would probably do is sit them down and show them a video of my fellow healthcare workers, some of whom are on ventilators, trying to have helped other people. I have a daughter-in-law who's getting ready to fly to New York City. She's a nurse and help in one of the hardest hit hospitals as their healthcare workers begin to be exhausted or to get sick. And I love the thing that you may have seen in the news that says, we're staying here in the hospital. You stay home. This has been an amazing, magnanimous display of love for our patients, is the way I would put it. At Mayo Clinic, we have a simple 7-word motto that we are living by: the needs of the patient come first. And they are living that motto even to the point of risking their own health and welfare. And I would ask people that could hear our voice, please take that seriously. Please take these social distancing guidelines and hand washing guidelines seriously. When 1,000 people come to the hospital inside of a week, the death rate goes up. When it's 10 people a week, you know, I'm just using round numbers, we can take 21st century care of them. And you can't predict who's going to have a severe illness, who's going to die.
You know, I'm being in the news media industry and practicing to the best of our ability the physical distancing, we're not able to, in some ways, see and hear kind of the ugly parts of this. There are stories out there you're hearing from family members who have lost loved ones. We've documented those. I guess my question, just broadly speaking, is have we not yet seen the ugly side of this because of the distance we need to keep? You're on the front lines of it. You see it. And, you know, I guess I'm not looking for you to paint an awful picture, but what's the reality? And have we just not seen it?
You know, I think the reality is that you're seeing doctors and nurses and respiratory therapists and phlebotomists and everybody else involved in making a hospital run, the administrators, I mean, everybody, you're seeing them work hours that are almost inhuman in some cases because they want to be there, not because they're told to be there. You're seeing them put themselves at risk. I've seen some of the videos. I've talked with some of my colleagues at other medical centers and in other countries where they are not as well prepared and don't have the equipment they need, and they walk into that room and take care of that patient anyway.
We all have been impacted, and that's maybe the one difference in this than, say, here in Northeast Florida, where we go through hurricane season and the rest of the country may not necessarily see it, feel it. How quickly do you fear that we're going to be at a point in our nation where the numbers will literally show us that we all will know someone who has either been hospitalized or has passed away?
Yeah, the projections are, and they're just that, projections, but what else can we really go on in trying to prepare and anticipate and plan, are that 40 to 70% of the U.S. will eventually be infected with this. Now, fortunately, the case fatality rate, if you look at the population level, while about 10 times higher than influenza, is still going to be, I think, in this 1%, 1.5% sort of range. That's what it's been so far. The problem is that we see much higher rates of fatality in older people or people who have a variety of other medical problems. So I do think, and I think that's sort of what you're pointing out, Rich, is that this is going to be a defining moment for all of us alive at this time in history. We'll look back and talk about this to some degree the way they must have in 1918 after the great influenza pandemic. And I think all of us want to be able to say we responded well.
What are the things that or points that maybe we haven't touched on that you're either seeing or hearing that you want to just either clear up a misconception, continue to drive home the point? Again, I want to be respectful of your time and get you out of here at a decent hour here.
Yeah, no, that this is important, and I'm happy to take the time because, the venue you have, I talk to one patient at a time. Through this mechanism, I can talk to, tens of thousands of people at a time. The social distancing and the hand washing are the most powerful things we know of. They are better than a vaccine or an antiviral. And I'm a vaccinologist. I believe in vaccines. I think taking those things seriously, working from home if you can, not letting your kids, since they're out of school, congregate at the malls, that's counterproductive. I think the other thing are the misconceptions. I've heard all sorts of, for us as physicians, horror stories of people gargling with dilute bleach solutions or saturating cotton plugs with bleach and putting it in their nose. Those are extraordinarily harmful and of no benefit whatsoever. I think another thing that's important is what I've been teaching called contextually appropriate layers of protection. So based on your context think about what would it be like to have this disease or to spread it to a family member, and then work backwards to say, what would you have been willing to do to prevent that? And then layering those protections around you and your family. And if we all do that in an appropriate way, I mean, we still have to live life. I understand that. But if we all do that in an appropriate way, we protect one another. And that leads to the kind of the last thing I would say, and the way I would summarize it is, I'm really hopeful that one thing that this virus does is change our society from me to we.
Do you feel we're there yet?
I think we're getting there. I really think that I see extremely bright spots. I see people as we are taking care of neighbors. I see people turning back to sort of spiritual roots. I see people helping other people, like elderly people who can't get out to shop, shopping for them. I see people, and this is a simple thing, but some young child, my wife and I went out for a walk along a pathway. Some young child had written, like every 50 feet, a little statement like, wash your hands, or please be careful, or, and that's just an indication of people thinking we instead of me. I also think there are other changes that are going to happen in our society. We are discovering that we can do work remotely. We can do schooling remotely. You may have seen this report, which I thought was fascinating. There has been the first drone delivery of critical medications to a rural area in Ireland. I think that's going to spread. So I think that there's always good and bad, but there are silver linings even in disaster, where it gives us the impetus to think in new ways and to accomplish things in new ways that we may actually be better off in.
How critical is it going to be to expand testing capabilities and also the faster results? For example, Mayo and Jacksonville announcing today that under a new partnership, the ability is there for several thousand tests per day and results perhaps within 24 hours.
Yeah, Mayo has really accelerated this. I'm just very proud to have any association with Mayo Jacksonville. They are leaders with this. And this is important, not only for the reason we talked about earlier of knowing who's infected, but eventually, and the technical term for what they're doing is called point of care testing, eventually to be able to have a blood-based test, might even be just a finger stick, where we can say, you've been infected, you're safe, you don't have to worry about this, and to understand for how long are people protected. That's one issue that we're wrestling with researchers. With the seasonal coronaviruses that circulate every year, immunity only lasts in terms of months. With SARS, it lasted at least 6 years. How long will it last with this novel coronavirus? We don't know. But this kind of testing is exactly what we needed. It's really very critical to understanding so that we can learn from this and be prepared. This is the third novel coronavirus we've had. Be prepared for coronavirus 4 and coronavirus 5.
There's been a pressure point of questions that have come up recently that we're hearing with increased frequency about, hey, you keep reporting things like death rate and confirmed rate. How about recovery rates? And we are seeing that they exist, Johns Hopkins, with the data that's there. How difficult is it, though, to fully understand a recovery or recovery rate? Are we there?
Yeah, see, so this is the tough part about any of the numbers that we report. The only thing we can report right now is in those either who have been tested, and that usually is the same group of people who have been severely ill and sought medical care. So these numbers are devoid of knowing, so to speak, mathematically, we know the numerator, we don't know the denominator. So my own feeling is if you have 100 cases in a community, you don't have 100, you have 300 or 1,000. You just don't know about them yet, or they have very mild symptoms. that they attributed to something else or didn't even feel sick. That is certainly possible. Somebody can be infected with this virus, have no symptoms, and be immune to it. Now, it's also possible, we're learning, that you can be asymptomatic, that is, without any symptoms, and spread the virus to somebody else. Probably not at the same rate as somebody who's actually coughing and sneezing and ill, but it is still possible.
What haven't we talked about that's important to know or anything that's on the cutting room floor that you want to make sure that you just reference yet again?
Because it's so important for people to understand hand washing. I would refer them, this is just one resource, if they go to YouTube and they search Dr. Poland, like the country, and Jimmy Kimmel, we do a skit on his show on hand washing where we use a substance that you put on your hands that's invisible and that it glows under a black light. And we actually show people how poorly they wash their hands. Hand washing is the best. Second best are the hand sanitizers. You have to use enough of it, somewhere around a quarter to a half dollar size glob of it. People put a little dime size there. You have to be sure to get the fingertips and thumbs. And you have to do that. The way I would put it is don't touch your face or eat until you've washed or sanitized your hands. This is the most important thing you and your family can reliably do.